Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, hello to my wonderful, wonderful audience, best in the whole world in this field of mental health, psychiatry, psychology, social work, counseling, coaching, the whole field of people trying to help people live better lives. I'm so great to be on the air for another year, presumably, and maybe many more in what has become a nice, long-lasting show, archived for all of you to go back years and find the shows. And if you go through my website, breggin.com, and click on my radio hour, you'll find an alphabetized capacity to search by name for any guest you might be hoping to find, some of whom have been on numerous times and some of whom have been on one or two times. If you want to, you find out, you know, what Bob Whitaker's had to say on the show, you can look up Whitaker. If you want to find out Joanna Moncrief, the wonderful psychiatrist in Great Britain, what she's had to say when she's been on the show, you can look up Moncrief. Now, I'm not really stalling right now, but I'm going to tell you something exciting that's going on, which is my guest for today is tied up in traffic in Los Angeles, racing to an airport. She's getting closer and closer. I won't tell you her name in case she can't make the show. Don't want to embarrass anybody. She's racing for the airport. When she gets there, she has an hour or more to talk with us, to continue a subject that we've been talking about before, which is going to have a lot to do with the FDA and with the latest shenanigans in the FDA to put the drug companies far, far ahead of the people, of you and me as consumers, you and me as ethical mental health professionals, if that's who we are. The FDA is, for me, an organization that needs to be challenged to its core. The kinds of issues that surround it are just really unbelievably complicated. You know, the FDA has gained power when on occasion terrible things have happened that have become worldwide, and the FDA then has been ramped up through legislation and through other things. Really, what does it do when it gets any power? The FDA tends mightily to protect industry. We had a terrible time getting the FDA, or I did have a terrible time getting the FDA to upgrade their warnings for tardive dyskinesia. And by the way, our antipsychotic drug and tardive dyskinesia center, resource center on my website is just growing. I've expanded it beyond tardive dyskinesia to antipsychotic drugs. I've got a wonderful write-up on on the TD as of now, and just dozens and dozens of PDFs of articles pertaining to this dread abnormal movement disorder that is also involves shrinkage of the brain and dementia and lesser cognitive disorders, which are often hard to predict. So That's still going to be there. And it's growing and growing. But back in 85, I managed to pressure the FDA to increase its warnings for tardive dyskinesia. I did it by chance. The Dan Rather reports, which was the most significant, you know, kind of news show at the time. Dan Rather was this enormously prestigious, much-loved individual. And his producer came to my home to talk to me about potential shows. And I suggested he do one on psychiatric drugs and tardive dyskinesia. And he did. And I had, you know, I had a good representation on the show, but there were other experts involved. And the result was a marvelous show that has been used in many universities ever since then as an exposé on psychiatric drugs. And so I did it in conjunction with my book coming out, my first medical book about drugs. My very first medical book was Electroshock, Its Brain Disabling Effects. My first medical book on drugs was Psychiatric Drugs, Hazards to the Brain. And I gave him the manuscript for that, and that's what led to the show, and he even promoted my book. And I did a lot of public education. We were able to do even more in those days because it was before the days of direct advertising, and there were fewer impediments to getting on major television, major radio shows, because they weren't beholden so much to the drug companies through direct-to-consumer advertising. Which, if my guest gets here, we may also touch on. Well, Paul Lieber, who was the head for many, many years of the psychiatric part of the FDA, the psychiatric drug approval part, he felt forced to hold a hearing and on this and to look into upgrading the warnings for TD. And he said during his first day at the hearings, which I was able to obtain through Freedom of Information Act, that industry shouldn't worry, and probably industry was the only people there, that industry shouldn't worry because the FDA wouldn't do anything to interfere with the interests of industry. Now, how are you going to increase the warnings on drugs? How are you going so that the people are more careful about giving them without hurting their business interests? How are you gonna monitor in any way without hurting their business interests? So from the start, you get this bizarre dance where the FDA is making believe, at least, and to some extent trying to fulfill its mandate to protect the public from drugs that do far more harm than good. And on the other hand, it's mostly protecting industry. So this is the ambivalent situation. Not many years ago, the FDA got empowered to by the president, I think, was probably pushing for it at the time, to intervene in cases against drug companies, to say that since the drug companies label, that is, their prescribing information, have been approved by the FDA, nobody could sue them for not having better information. So, I mean, the FDA was actually intervening on behalf of industry. And that happens a lot more than people might think. When we first started to take on the issues of the SSRI antidepressants that started with Prozac. So when we first started to take that on, the FDA held secret meetings before it opened officially in the mornings with Eli Lilly in order to make sure that neither the FDA nor Eli Lilly would look like they Prozac, you know, they'd missed that Prozac was causing violence and suicide. And of course, Lilly at the time knew it was causing suicide and violence because their own internal materials, as I've outlined in many of my books, including talking back to Prozac, they knew a lot of what was going on from their own research. Their own research showed an increased rate of suicide attempts compared to older antidepressants and compared to placebo, data they never gave out. And when I got that data from being a medical expert, the medical expert for all the initial combined Prozac suits, I told the FDA about it. They never asked to see it. They never wanted to see it. They never wanted to interview me about all these materials that I found inside the company. So we definitely have the FDA performing to a great extent as an adversary. And this, this just goes on and on and continues to go on. And today we may talk with my guest, if she can make it to the airport and find a place to sit and call in. God, I tell you, I know how that is from traveling. I know how that is. We may get to talk about direct-to-consumer advertising. We may get to talk about off-label advertising. At any rate, the FDA is not our friend. It is really the friend of the drug companies. Now, this is intrinsic to the system. Whenever the federal government attempts to, on the basis of legislation from Congress, to become a watchdog, it then, that new agency, the new watchdog function of an agency, immediately becomes susceptible to lobbying, if not directly, then through congressmen, through the executive branch, pressure being put on Congress and the executive branch. Now, Prozac, I don't believe in a world free of lobbying would ever have been approved. I mean, it was just a rotten drug when you looked at the data that went into the approval process. It was just a terrible drug. I mean, all you could say about it was that it just caused horrible adverse effects. You couldn't say that it did anything really good. We now know, of course, from excellent research that that the antidepressant drug studies done for the FDA taken as a group show that these drugs that don't work, basically, just don't. They're not antidepressants. Now, on the other hand, let's look at industry. So on the one hand, I do believe in government monitoring. I mean, it seems like it is a necessity, isn't it? But actually, much like psychiatric treatment in general, it's doing far more harm than good in many, many ways. In fact, it justifies the whole idea of giving psychiatric drugs. I mean, think about it. It justifies giving psychiatric drugs. Okay. Now, I've just gotten a little message from my guest, and this isn't a bad time to shift over to her. I'm going to make sure that she's online. But I want to then just say briefly, before I go to introduce her again, that the other problem we have is industry. So, you know, I'd like to believe in the FDA and I'd like to believe in industry. I tend to be a supporter of industry. I'd like to say that, you know, America is great. It has great industry. But everything I learn about the drug industry is you absolutely can't trust them whatsoever. In every arena they get into, they are they're just not performing ethically. They do everything they can to get away with, to false advertise, to advertise off-label, to influence the people in the trenches. What do we have? We have, on one hand, the FDA. We are relying on them doesn't work. We have, on the other hand, relying on industry. and that doesn't work. I mean, I was just dumbfounded when I started looking inside GlaxoSmithKline on Paxil. Dumbfounded when I first looked inside Lilly on Prozac. And that was disillusioning. So where do I go? Okay. Well, my client is my client. I have been connected, and I haven't known it for 10 minutes. Kim, are you there?
I am here. Thank you so much.
Oh, you've
much.
Been listening to me. You should have shouted out. But you're too polite.
I'm a nice
So listen, folks, I'm going to just tie this up now and just say, who do we rely on? We can't rely on the FDA. We can't rely on industry. We can't rely on a lot of what I do, which is lawsuits, being an expert witness, product liability, being an expert witness in malpractice. It doesn't even dent this issue. And besides, a lot of what the judges think and the juries think is corrupted by the drug companies. So given that situation, we have a great introduction to my guest, Kim Witczek. Kim, her last name is spelled W-I-T-C-Z-A-K. Kim was on just a few months ago or less because she has so much to say about stuff. Kim is an independent freelance advertising art buyer, producer, production manager, does shoots and stuff for advertising. She got into this area about 12 years ago when her husband, who was really a healthy and a wonderful man, and I'm going to do this in an abbreviation so we can get to the subjects that we want to talk about. And she did speak about this on her earlier show, which you can look up on the radio page. So Kim lost her husband eventually to suicide. He was taking, was it Zoloft?
Yeah, Zoloft. Mm-hmm.
And he was taking it not for a psychiatric problem, but for sleep, which is a weird thing for a doctor to prescribe it for because, yeah, sure, it sedates some people, but it overstimulates others. And you can just read that in the label. I mean, a lot of people are getting sedated. A lot of people are getting overstimulated. Well, Kim responded ultimately to this tragedy by becoming an incredible consumer advocate, by managing to get on to the FDA Psychopharmaceutical Drugs Advisory Committee, the committee that makes recommendations to the FDA on things like label changes and things like should a drug get accepted and allowed on the market. And she's been there since 2016. So she's just got a lot to tell us today. And, you know, she's going to talk about Shantex and what's been happening there. And she's going to be talking about the efforts of the drug companies to be allowed to promote their drugs for things they're not approved for, off-label promotion. Hi, Kim. You got to listen to me just sit here and unload my heart about the FDA.
Well, it's great. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. As you mentioned, I'm at the airport trying to come back from L.A., and it's interesting. I was listening to you talk about direct-to-consumer advertising, and, you know, I'm in the business. I've been in the business for over 25 years, and I love the advertising business, but I believe really strongly that the DTC has completely changed the game of, you know, healthcare and the drugs and who's got the power and knowing the type of things that we do in every day for, you know, marketing, you know, automobiles and, you know, rental cars and hotels, it's not the same thing as, it shouldn't be the same thing as an approach that we go at marketing drugs. They're the same thing. It's no different in the way that they market it. They're taking on, you know, they're hiring the brightest people, MBAs, to know how to manipulate and to change consumer behavior. So I couldn't have come on come in and listen to a better, more close topic. As you mentioned, the direct-to-consumer is really, I'm really passionate about that, but also off-label. And what you were saying about the FDA and Chantix and what recently just happened with the FDA removing the black box warning from Chantix, which is an anti-smoking drug. So I don't know where you want to start, but I have a lot of things to talk about.
Well, let's just go into this. I mean, Chantix, we have more evidence for violence from Chantix than for any other drug. Thomas Moore, in his study, you can Google it, Tom Moore Chantix, or just Tom Moore FDA violence, you'll get there. How does the FDA come by taking the drug where there's the most evidence for it being the worst drug for one of the worst things a drug can do, which is cause violence? How'd they go about that? What did they do with the Tom Moore evidence?
Yeah, it's really interesting. If you know, looking back at the history of, it was in 2000, I think 14 was the first hearing where Pfizer approached the FDA wanting to get the black box warning removed. And at that time, the advisory committee, and I was not a member of the advisory committee, decided, well, we need more research, right? We need more research. Well, fast forward, Pfizer funds this new study where they're an observational study where they're looking at, around the globe. Anytime, so then they came back to the FDA in October of this year wanting to, again, remove the black box warning. And now they had their completed study. And it was interesting. So now I'm on the committee, the Psychopharmacologic Advisory Committee, and so I was excited to go and really be able to ask questions and really get a sense of what they were trying to do, because this is an unprecedented move for the FDA. That was one of the questions that somebody asked. It's never been done. Maybe there was one drug that had, it was really a cancer drug where they removed a black box warning, but not in something that's mass marketed like a Chantix. And you look at that drug. So I was all set to go and be a member on the committee. And literally, 5 days before I was supposed to travel, I received an email from the FDA saying that I was not able to participate in the committee because they saw and they considered me to have an intellectual bias, conflict of interest, because I had a lawsuit against Pfizer that resolved almost 10.5 years ago. So I did eventually, it was almost like they broke up with me over email, and I ended up having a conversation with the FDA asking how they could do this. And basically they said I couldn't come there even to be a non-voting member on the committee, just so I could ask questions. And they've done that before and had allowed Sid Wolf, Public Citizen, to do the same thing. So I thought, well, maybe they'll still let me be on the committee and ask questions, because that's really what I wanted to do. And the answer was no. So I still showed up at the hearing and was able to address the fact that, when you're going to go and consider removing a black box warning, you need to consider all evidence and all, talking, Tom Moore, that's the FDA. That's all the reports that went into FDA's own MedWatch system, the most reported side effects being the violence. Then you have the 2,700 lawsuits that were all resolved and all silenced. So all those victims could not come and tell their story. And that was Pfizer that shut them all up. So you didn't hear any of their stories. And those lawsuits were all before the drug ever had a black box warning on. So you never even heard from those people. And then, the Pfizer does their little dog and pony show. And of course, when you're in, their business is to get the black box warning off because it's got another year, I think, left of patent. There's a lot, they could start marketing it differently without a black box warning. It's going to be fun. It's safe. But what's interesting at this hearing versus the one in October, is this one had a lot of the patient, or I'm not even, this isn't really patient advocacy groups, but it was the tobacco anti-smoking groups that were out there advocating for removing the black box warning because, smoking is it's a public health issue. So they were all up one after the next during the public hearing. And then it was interesting to go back and look and see how many of those anti-smoking groups actually received money and funding from the drug industry. So, so it was a very interesting kind of well thought out machine, with the industry, getting their partners, getting people that were out there promoting it. And ultimately, at the end of the day, the committee voted to remove the black box warning. And, obviously the FDA did not have to follow suit by it, but eventually they did, because last month in October, or the end of December, the FDA came out and said they were removing the black box warning. And already it's being, kind of PR'd, or the PR machines are out there, making it seem like there wasn't any issue. And then, at the end of the day, the doctors are going to be confused because, the drug reps are going to be in there saying that, we've taken the black box warning off. So the doctors are going to be using it and giving it to patients who do want to quit smoking. And then patients are going to take it thinking, well, it's got to be safe because the FDA took the black box warning off. And who's going to pay the price? The public is. And I'm always fascinated at these advisory committees after, when you go through and everybody votes. Afterwards, you get to go around and kind of give your comments, of the event of the day. And almost every one of them said, well, I don't think the data is quite there. So then I'm thinking, why did you vote to take it off? I mean, these are huge public health consequences by taking it off. And I also feel like it's more because it's an unprecedented move by the FDA. I'm more concerned about our antidepressants next, because I hear a lot of the mental health groups that are out there right now that are saying that the black box warning on antidepressants is part of the problem of why we're teen suicide rates are up, and because people are afraid to take the drugs because of the warning. So it's going to be interesting to kind of see what comes out of this new world, as I call it, the new world of removing black box warning. Especially, as Peter, we were all there back in 2004 fighting to get the black box warning put on to antidepressants, and it takes a lot of work to get one on. So now to see how easy it could come off with an observational study that's paid by the industry makes me a little nervous.
Yes, it's, I guess the whole theme, in a way, was a little depressing in my introduction of what do we do, because at this point the FDA is definitely, more the enemy than the friend of the people. Now the talk you gave to the FDA, that was just as a private citizen who signed up to talk. Or did you get to go up on the stand there, go up at the table?
I was only able to get, 4 minutes, like every other person who signed up during the public hearing. But I was able to say some of the things of what you're not hearing. You're not hearing from the 2,700 victims. You're not hearing from their lawyers who actually saw the documents that actually shows the behavior of the companies. You're not hearing from, you're not getting Tom Moore, who has, the Institute of Safe Medication Practices has done one of the most thorough analysis of Chantix. You gave him three, four minutes, no more than you gave me. So why aren't you hearing? If you're going to take off a black box warning, you have to hear from all sides. Well, personally, I think that's something we should be doing for every drug approval. It shouldn't just be industry. We should have independent scientists that are out there who have done an analysis. I think back to those 2004 and 2006 antidepressant hearings. Why didn't they have somebody like you get up there and be able to present in a longer format the data that you knew and the information you knew? Because they don't want to hear it. I feel like a lot of times the advisory panels are set up more for approval than really into the looking at the safety side of things. And my only fear is that looking at what could potentially be coming with a new FDA commissioner under the new administration, where they're talking about, does it even have to prove to be effective? So it'll be interesting to see what happens at the FDA. Because they work for us, but in reality, it's in looking at some of the other controversial drug approvals that aren't even in the psychiatric area, you see it's politics. And I say this all the time. I go, the average doctor, the average person going to in middle America or in any city has no idea the political process of the FDA approval.
Did you just say politics, or did you coin a new word? My ear heard power ticks, which is really a new good word. But did you say politics?
That's a great one. I said both of those, but not together. So yes, you're right. I like that. I love that word.
Power ticks, folks, is a new word now. Yeah, this land of ours is more and more about power ticks. We should do a blog about that. Did the committee and folks, I want you to listen to all this because this is really a very, very good insight into how evil the system is. I mean, this is just plain evil. Kim was witnessing evil and trying to influence it and move it. So was Tom Moore. Did they even discuss? Well, first, let me give you folks a summary on what Tom Moore's study was. And it's so easy to just Google it. But what Tom did is he looked at all of the reports of violence to the FDA, and he found out that 85% of the drugs, I think the figure had one or two or no reports, and that the reports were focused on a particular group of drugs more than others, which were the psychiatric drugs, but that not all the reports were psychiatric drugs. And if you factored in the number of prescriptions, so a drug wasn't overrepresented by its number of prescriptions, certainly there'd be a lot of prescriptions for Chantix and for the antidepressants. But if you did that, the leading drug by far for violence reports was Chantix. And Chantix, actually, if you look at its profile, a lot of what it's doing seems to have the profile of adverse effects of antidepressant drugs. And there were also two or three other drugs, including antibiotics, that were associated with violence. And some antibiotics have actually suicide warnings on them, by the way. Two things came out of the study. One was, yes, antidepressants, benzos, and some other psychiatric drugs, and you can look at the individual ones that are most associated with, do produce a disproportionate number of violence reports. And some drugs for which you wouldn't expect any reports are nonetheless getting reports, which suggests that they probably would have even more reports if it ever entered their mind that an antibiotic or smoking drug could produce violence. So this data was very strong on Chantix. It was just amazingly strong. So it should have actually emboldened the black box and let it get more specific about violence. But it didn't. It didn't have any effect at all. And instead, the drug company does one of their always fraudulent studies. That's what they put them out for, is to get an effect. They're just PR. And the FDA goes with them, goes with the drug company. It's we're talking about something that folks just really need to mull on. And I'm kind of glad in a way that, Kim, that I got to you late. It turned out, folks, Kim was there. Kim was there really on time, or nearly on time, despite all the trouble she had racing, and that I didn't pick up on my instant messaging with the engineer due to a flaw in this operator. and then no one else. Kim was actually here for 10 minutes listening to my intro about the FDA. So it's no fault here except my own. But I'm glad I got to talk about the dismalness of the situation, because this is just a terrible illustration of it. And we all need to mull on this, because I'm not exactly sure what the answer is. Industry can't be trusted. The FDA can't be trusted. Suing can't be trusted. And in fact, it's astonishing, for example, that in the case of Chantix, every single person who had a reasonable suit settled and gave up their rights in that process voluntarily. They voluntarily said, yes, I'll take the money and I'll keep quiet. I don't blame people for that. I've heard Kim say she doesn't blame people for that. But that's what the system is doing. I mean, maybe that should not be allowed. I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, I would love, you know, I'm with you, Peter, because I'm a suit advocate and believer in the legal system, because, you know, as attorneys, and I've been doing a lot of speaking to mass tort attorneys, the attorneys that are actually out there representing victims against the companies, and really trying to get them to understand that, you know, from a bigger picture than just even their client. And to be honest with you, a lot of clients don't, they just want this to go away for them. You know, this is a horrible time in their life. They don't want to go out and become advocates and do what I want to do, you know, do something like I've done. But, you know, as lawyers, they should be really thinking about the access that they have, because they're the only inroad into a company file, right, is through the legal system. The FDA can't, they can ask for things, but they can't go in there. It's the legal system that can get into inside company files and actually find, it might be the needle in the haystack, the documents that start showing how they've done this, and done it intentionally. And like in the case of Zoloft and Chantix, like all those documents that clearly they were there. And I know that I think it was Glenn Mullen, both Glenn Mullen, Tom Moore were experts in those Chantix cases and have seen them. And those documents are forever lost. They're sealed, and who loses out? Ultimately, the public does, because we will never know. And the FDA. So even for the good folk, and I think there are a lot of good people inside the FDA that do the work, but I think, you know, it's a political thing at top. But that really want to do that, but they don't even have access to this, to these documents. So I also have heard that it was after the antidepressant and all the lawsuits that Pfizer learned something, and that was the power of the people and the stories that are out there being advocates. So that was part of their agreement from the beginning. You had to, you know, they silenced everyone. So they basically took away the First Amendment rights for individuals. And I find this really ironic when I look at all the off-label. And, you know, the FDA just had an off-label hearing where they're actually looking at whether or not companies can legally market and promote their drugs for indications that have not been FDA approved, right? So they claim, and the reason the FDA held this hearing is because there was a Supreme Court ruling in favor, and it was a small drug company, a small biotech company, that they are going, that literally went up to Supreme Court and said it's First Amendment, a company's First Amendment right, so they can promote for their, you know, promote their products. So basically, the Supreme Court is, you know, this one particular ruling, which I know is what everybody's pushing for, the industry is, to be able to legally promote, you know, versus paying those billions of dollars of fines that they've been paying. But I find that ironic that they're arguing First Amendment rights, and yet they take away individuals' First Amendment rights when you get into the legal system and silence them. Like, they literally, on these Chantix, they can never go and even publicly lobby and tell their story. Imagine I could never tell what happened to Woody what good would have come out of it. So anyways, there's me on my First Amendment right.
No, this is all very, very important. I don't in any way make light of what you're saying. Another thing that happens that the drug companies do, and I don't know whether this has happened with Chantix, but they will give sufficiently large enough settlements that the lawyers are very pleased with their piece of it. And in return, the lawyers agree to take no more cases.
Right.
So in some areas, it's become increasingly difficult to even get a very high profile or reputable attorney to take a case against the drug companies, because when you call them, and I don't call them directly, but if, you know, an attorney calls them to see if they might be interested in taking a case, the answer is we can't take a case like this. And often the reason for that is they've actually got an agreement that they can't even tell you about, that they settled the one, two, three, or a handful of cases or whatever on this subject, and they've agreed in return for the settlements not to take any more cases. I mean, this is quite incredible what goes on, folks, behind the scenes, even in America. Kim, you raised an issue which I'm not, I may have a mistaken idea about. You said that the FDA can't ask the drug companies, demand to see all of their internal machinations, much like, you know, courts have empowered me to go into the drug companies and look at their internal documents. It's called discovery. Can't the FDA do that if it wanted to?
No. The only arm that can literally be able to legally go in and start looking at files, yes, they can ask for things and they demand things and whatnot, but you have no idea if it's all, you know, is it every box? But as an attorney, you know, I think back to antidepressants and some of my attorneys that literally sat in, you know, they were out in Pfizer's files in their company documents for weeks.
Yeah, I've been there too. I've been out there in Pfizer's company documents for two or three days going through their stuff. Yeah.
Right. But you, because it's the legal system, but the FDA can't get it. They can ask for it, and they, but they can't, they don't, there's no way to really ensure that it's all of it. So I think back to one of the documents.
So they can't demand it? They can't write to them and say, listen, Eli Lilly, I heard from a medical expert, and he's put it in his book, being me, that you did studies on Prozac suicide attempts in your control clinical files and found a 9 or 12 to 1, depending on how you counted it, higher ratio of actual attempts in your clinical trials. And you did this at the request of the German agency. You never gave it to them and you never gave it to us. We want it. They can't do that?
Yep. No, I think a lot of that stuff, they can ask for things, but like the secret documents, I'm sure like some of those studies they can ask because it was, you know, now public knowledge, but it's the stuff that you like, a lot of the legal documents, and this is, again, from my understanding, is, you know, a lot of it, they want to go after the marketing, because the marketing is actually where a lot of the illegal side of things
happening.
So, you know, they can ask, so you heard about the study, and I'm not sure if it came out, did it come out from one of the lawsuits, did it come out, so they could ask, you know, they should be able, and they should, like if, I remember after the Chantix hearing in 2014, myself and Tom Moore went up to Bob Temple afterwards, who is at the FDA and has been at the FDA for a long time and managing, you know, he was part of the whole antidepressant. And we said to him, you should demand to see all the documents that were uncovered during the legal litigation. He's like, no, those are all just individual cases. That's not anything that we would care about.
Oh, that's really, excuse like, making, because, in fact, most of the benefits I got weren't about individual cases. They were these internal studies, some of them.
Right. But I think that's kind of, I mean, that has definitely been his, I mean, that's clearly what he said to Tom and I. We're like, no, there's actually, these are not lawsuits, you know, an individual. Yes, it's individual, but it's really on behalf of the what's going on with the company. So that you do want to see it. It's not about, like, what happened to, like, Woody, per se, case. It's all the stuff that goes around how Woody even actually got onto a drug. You know, it's the marketing. It's the science. It's the ghostwriting. It's the, you know, just kind of business as usual. How do they bring a drug to market?
Do you want to talk some more about this? Do you have more information on the effort to allow the drug companies to promote off-label, that is to promote drugs for things for which they have not been FDA approved and indeed may have been turned down when mm-hmm. they tried to get approval? Can you tell us more about that? Do you have more information?
Well, right now the FDA was just looking, like I said, I mentioned that case that had went up to Supreme Court. So there's a lot of companies that have been pushing back on the ability to be able to promote things off-label. At the same time, on the other hand, you've got all the Department of Justice and these big fines that have been paid over the years for promoting a drug that the companies have paid for promoting a drug for, you know, to a certain population. It might be the elderly, and a lot of them are in the psychiatric drug arena.
It's often the psych drugs that they're getting right. these billion-dollar fines for.
Right, and so this has been something that the FDA has been looking and considering. So they held a two-day hearing back in early November, and on the first day it was mostly industry representatives, both drug and device, and then as well as, you know, the legal experts. But the legal experts from, you know, more, I guess, constitutional or more on the side of the industry, you know, heads of law schools that came. And most of them are all talking about the First Amendment rights. They have, a company has the right, as long as the science is there, and they've done the studies, that they have the right to promote it. But what was really interesting for the first time, and I always love going to these things because I get new insights of kind of connecting all the dots, the drug and device industry kept talking about the payers and you know, the health insurance payers. The payers was a word that I hadn't really heard in all of these FDA things that I, you know, meetings that I've been to over the years. But this is a really big deal because, you know, obviously some of these drugs and devices that are being used off-label are very expensive. And, you know, and if they're not approved or you can't legally promote it, that, you know, a lot of times payers, the insurance companies, deny it or won't pay for it. So that was their kind of new strategy. And then on the day two, and there was a few people that had been victims, you know, for that have actually been impacted. Somebody who got a bad, something that was never approved for the neck device in a medical device. So they spoke. But then day two was really a bunch of victims or people, patients, consumers, consumer groups. There were no lawyers that were actually representing patients because there were some, you know, there was a client there that she was on a generic Zofran, which is a to help with nausea that's really meant for cancer, but it starts being used off-label because what's a bigger, much bigger market for an anti-nausea drug would be pregnant women. And so these women started taking this drug off-label and had their babies that were born with heart defects, birth defects. So it was really interesting to hear the 2 days. And I have to say, Dr. Califf, the FDA commissioner, actually was there and asked questions of the panel, or, you know, the different speakers. He asked me several questions because, you know, obviously Woody got a drug off label. You know, just he did what most of, you know, patients do. If the doctor gives it to you, you assume that they're giving it to you because it's been approved for that condition. So there's a lot of inherent trust in the whole off-label kind of prescribing. But then I also look at, I counter that with, and I was very upfront with this even in my talk, that I have a really good friend who found out she had stage 4 glioblastomy, and there was a off-label drug, Avastin, who's had a lot of problems in its intended approved use, but they were trying it for, stage 4 brain tumors. And 5 years later, she's still around. And so, but she knew the dangers, and she knew that the drug was being used off-label, and it wasn't approved for that use. But the average person that gets put on off-label drugs off-label has no idea. They don't even know to ask the question. So I'm out there wanting to educate the public to even ask, just start a conversation with your doctor, because then don't just assume that the drug that they're giving is approved for that condition. And if it's not, then there should be a conversation. Like, tell me why, because the FDA is not in the business of, telling a doctor what they can and cannot do. So the only thing they can do is more from the company. So once a drug is on the market, and I think last time we talked about these new fast-tracking approaches to get a drug on the market faster, well, imagine once a drug or device is on the market faster, a doctor can use it any way they want. They can use it. So now it's going to allow the companies to get in there and start promoting it. You know, it's all about market share. I mean, it's a business. And so I think it's going to be a very interesting to see how the FDA actually ultimately comes down on this issue, because right now it's just seeking public input. I think your audience should know that they have an opportunity to write into the FDA with their thoughts about being able to use drugs off-label. I mean, it doesn't say that we can't use drugs off-label. It's the idea of legally being able to market and promote, which is very different. So I think, you know, a lot of people, the other side, patients over there are saying, if I wasn't able to be able to use this drug off-label, my kid wouldn't be around. That's not what this argument's really about, but that's what they're trying to get it entangled into the conversation. It's really about, can you legally promote it? Because, you know, then you can start creating your science and building your business around the science, and I'm putting that in quotes, giving you the air quotes, to support your marketing claims. So.
Yeah, let me ask you something about that. I don't know how this came up. It had to have been discussed, I would think. If they're going to make off-label suggestions to doctors, like, GSK thinks this drug is good for such and such, what do they have to say to avoid their being sued for fraud? Because if they're saying the drug is good for something or should be used for something, and they don't have good evidence, it seems to me they're going to be open to fraud suits that they would not be open to, of course, when they tell doctors stuff that's FDA approved. Did that come up at all? Are they going to need, for example, their own controlled clinical trial that never got submitted to the FDA, or what?
Well, I think, that was what they were talking about. You know, this wasn't just loosely saying, oh, we can go, just, you know, it's on the market and we've done like a little study for 5 people and it shows that it works, you know, whatever. They have to be able to like scientifically prove it and show it. But, you know, with clinical studies, it's all about how you design it, what's the outcome, what are you studying? You know, you have to be able to look deeper than that. But there was a lot of talking about that they want to be able to promote evidence base. But then at the same time, this is just my understanding or from my perspective, if you have that kind of data, why aren't you able to then apply for an application to get it approved for that specific intended use? Or is it just, you know, that's where I, you know, those are some of the questions.
Well, and also, why even have an FDA approval process?
Right.
If once you get it approved for anything, you can then just create your own process to get itself approved for all other things. I mean, that's
funny
really
you said that.
So. I mean, then that you wouldn't have to do what they do now. Some drugs, like Paxil, I think it has approval of 5 or 6 different things, because it's such a potent neurotoxin, it will suppress almost any symptom you want to measure for at least 4 to 6 weeks. So you get these really potent toxins, and they, you know, they can get, you can get them approved for anything. You know, now they'd only have to get Paxil approved for one thing, and then they could just go tell the doctors, well, we've got a study for this and a study for that, without spending all the money and going through the rigmarole to get FDA approval, which I gather is increasingly becoming rubber stamp, isn't it? More and more.
Right. And it's, you know, you think about every application, you know, we're coming up on 2017, where we're going to have, it's PDUFA, the Prescription Drug User Fee Act, and MDUFA, you know, the Device Act. But it's basically where the industry pays with every drug application. They pay a big fee that basically is, you know, supporting our FDA, and that's how our FDA, a good portion of it is being funded. Well, that legislation is coming up this year, and it's a must-pass legislation. So it'll be interesting because it's, you know, it's a lot of money to try to get a drug approved. So I got to think there's business. There's always some type of business motivation behind things, whether it's still grounded in, you know, wanting to do the right thing. But to your point, I wonder how eventually it can be legally, if you could. But then I think there's, you know, I heard a lot of things that some of my lawyer friends said, you have to be able to get. The only way you're going to be able to sue is if, you know, you can prove fraud, but you can't really prove fraud if you're able to do this. So it's like that whole idea of fraud and proving of fraud, I think it's going to be an interesting one and how it plays out with the legal system.
Kim,
as well.
pronounce your last name good and loud and correctly.
Witsack, like a sack of wits.
Witsack.
Yep.
Kim Witsack, WITCZAK, living proof of what one individual, through sheer determination, motivation, sincerity, and honesty, can accomplish. You're an inspiration. Thank you so much for being again on Dr. Peter Bregan Hour, Kim. Thank you.
Have a great day.
Have a great year, too. Bye-bye now, folks.
Bye.